You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the New York Times reported on the firing of former Reddit CEO Ellen Power earlier this summer, the story drew comments and criticism from readers who argued that what began as a news article had morphed into an opinion piece over the course of a few hours of updating. The Times public editor responded by stating that the paper has increasingly moved away from a straight, neutral approach to news to providing, quote, valued added coverage and analysis. But The Times is not alone. This is part of a shift in journalism that has occurred over the past few decades, marked by the increase of analytical and interpretive news articles that some argue violate objectivity and journalistic ethics. Joining me now to talk about these changes and the challenges facing reporters today are Arthur Brisbane, a former public editor at The Times, Vanessa Ghazari, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Jay Rosen, a journalism professor and media critic at New York University. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Now, Arthur, readers criticized The Times for implying that Ellen Powell was fired as a result of sexism at Reddit in the July article, which was headlined, "It's Silicon Valley 2, Ellen Powell 0, Fighter of Sexism is Out at Reddit." Are you surprised by the readers' reaction?
Well, no. Having served in that role as public editor, you know, you often find strong responses to articles where what is kind of presented as straight reportage seems to carry additional interpretive material that some people would simply describe as a slant. I think there's a lot of confusion over what news articles are supposed to contain and where the boundaries are supposed to be. So, no, I wasn't surprised.
In your final column as the Times public editor in August 2012, you wrote, "Across the paper's many departments, though, so many share a kind of political and cultural progressivism, for lack of a better word, that this worldview virtually bleeds through the fabric of the Times." What did you mean by that? The Times has a liberal bias?
I know, that's a radical thought. Well, you know, when I came into the job, a lot of people told me that, and I had clung to the view that the Times really upheld a more neutral stance. When I got inside the building, I came around to feeling that there was, as a stated mandate and objective, to maintain the neutral stance, but that when you got closer to the people, you realized that their worldview was such that it was extremely difficult to stay neutral. So, in effect, what goes on inside the journalist's head ends up on the pages and on the website of the paper. So there is a kind of a cultural bias that is hard to filter out for the institution itself.
Although the Times has been accused of having biases in both directions and having, in fact, been a cheerleader for the lead up to the war in Iraq, so it gets a bit more complicated, doesn't it? Your successor as public editor, Margaret Sullivan, wrote that the paper's reporters and editor are providing context and value-added coverage. Is there a difference between providing context and conveying a perspective?
Well, yes. In theory, certainly there is. Context, one can only hope, could be value neutral, could entail historical perspective, a balanced presentation of different points of view. Context by itself is not necessarily biased, but it's very hard to pull off. So, you know, I take the view that they are often successful at the Times with providing context. And then there are occasions when it doesn't work out. It's very difficult when you move from just reporting facts to providing more interpretive material.
Vanessa,
it's much more complex.
Vanessa, is it possible to provide neutral analysis when the topic is divisive or polarizing?
Yes,
I
think that journalists are trained to provide that kind of perspective, but in the very word perspective suggests a truth, which is that journalists are not robots. So, you know, every time you have a human mind looking at information and contextualizing it, you have someone bringing his or her own experience to it as a lens or a filter. And I think that, you know, that in reality, that's just very difficult, impossible to get rid of.
The Times readers also noted that the article was updated several times on the web over the course of the evening, causing the final story to look very different from the initial story that was reported. Is that something that we're seeing more and more as newspapers lean on the internet for their readership?
Absolutely, and I think it's something that readers are increasingly aware of and concerned about, and there have been several instances of this recently, especially at the Times. Actually, CJR had a recent story about something called diffing, which I know that Arthur is also familiar with, but the idea of actually showing the multiple versions of a story as the changes are made so that the readers can sort of track what happened, and that might be more transparent. Other people say it would be just a lot of extra stuff for readers to wade through, but I think it's an interesting question.
But isn't this a natural process? I would think that after a story is published and then reporters get some kind of feedback from their colleagues and from readers, they might feel, well, maybe I should add this detail and that detail. And the next thing you know, they're providing a lot more background than they had in the original article.
Yeah, I think it's a natural process in that sense. Of course, you know, to state the obvious, the internet makes this much, much easier to do. I mean, there was a time when you wrote a story and it went in the paper and that was it, basically. I mean, now you can update and change articles endlessly. And I think one of the complaints that the public editor spoke about on the POW story was just how many changes were made to that story to the point where readers thought they were looking at a completely different piece 24 hours later.
My guests are Vanessa Ghazari, managing editor of Columbia Journalism Review, Arthur Brisbane, the former public editor at The Times, and Jay Rosen, a journalism professor and media critic at New York University. And Jay, you've written about objectivity in journalism on your blog, Press Think, which is published by the journalism program at NYU. You often refer to the view from nowhere. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's my way of describing the same thing Arthur and others might call objectivity, but looking at it from a more skeptical point of view. So the view from nowhere, which is what journalists are in many ways taught to take when they start out, doesn't help us locate or get our bearings in public space. You could also say that objectivity is the belief that viewlessness is the ideal state for a journalist. And I think there's reason to question that. I use the term the view from nowhere to emphasize, A, how impossible that is.
Objectivity is an impossible ideal?
In an abstract way, it's hard to accredit that idea. But also that there's something missing here, right? There's something missing when people take the view from nowhere, which is increasingly important in how we come to trust writers and journalists, and that is, where are you coming from?
Is the concept of objectivity unique to American journalism? Are we moving more and more towards something that Europeans would recognize?
The consensus model of news reports that demonstrate their viewlessness and neutrality and building a commercial enterprise around that to capture as many readers or viewers as possible, that model is an American invention. It's also tied to a sort of a public service journalism concept that's also very potent around the world.
I throw this out to all of you. Does an objective perspective provide a sense of authority to the writer?
Well, anytime somebody can say that's not true, or you don't have facts to back that up, or that's never been verified, that undermines an argument. So I think what we should be talking about is not necessarily the objectivity of the writer or the journalist or the Times, but how vigilant they are about verification. Verification is just not the same thing as the view from nowhere.
Vanessa, you spent 3 years reporting from Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Kashmir, and Sri Lanka following 9/11. Was remaining objective ever a challenge for you as a war reporter?
I don't like the word objectivity. And when I teach, I actually tell my students that it's something that I don't believe in. And I do that partly to be provocative. I don't mean to suggest that journalists should have a very hard line. That's obviously not in line with what we do. But to your question, it wasn't so much that I wasn't, you know, that my objectivity was challenged. It was that there was no way I could be a fly on the wall in that world that I entered after September 11th. I was a foreigner. A young American woman walking into a village in Afghanistan is not something ordinary. It's not something that is going to strike people as it's completely loaded. That is, even if I am impartial in my approach, the way people regard me makes the situation, I become part of the story. And there's no way to get away from that. And I found that in all of the coverage I did in South and Central Asia, which is really where I came of age as a reporter. And I think it's really influenced my thinking about these things.
In your experience as managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, what's the biggest challenge that journalists are facing today? Or challenges?
Goodness.
For example, the web forces us all to try to be there first.
Yes, I think that is true. And I think that we all know that when you work faster and you don't have sometimes all the sources you need, you end up putting things out there before they're actually ready, and then you have to update and update. I think that's a challenge. You know, there are many now. I think all of us in the media business are looking at a landscape that's vastly different from what it was even just a few years ago.
Jay, has the web enabled more journalists to produce more in-depth investigative pieces without having to worry about the limitations of space?
Well, if they are employed to be investigative journalists, then yes, they have more space. They can do more. They can present not only their story, but the data that they used. So if they are employed, they have more room. If they're not, that's the problem.
Although some of the best journalism I've seen recently in the New York Times has started on the front page and then taken up two or three pages inside.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask all of you this. Columbia University journalism students Catherine Fink and Michael Schutzen published a paper in 2013 that analyzed the rise of contextual journalism over the past 50 years, and they found that conventional news stories, which focus on the who, what, when, and where, declined nearly 50% at three major newspapers over the same period. Does news reporting require more context today?
I would throw in the idea that the decline that they recorded was partly a function of what's happened in the competitive landscape in journalism, with so many competitors in different media addressing the reader or the viewer, each media form and every journalist has to seek out a kind of a niche in which they can survive and add something that another isn't doing. And the facts, as kind of a journalistic product, became more of a commodity. And this underlines, at least in part, this expansion of the interpretive contextual material. It's a function of competition, among other things, I think.
Another thing happening there is that during the same period, mid-60s to the 90s, journalism is becoming a more attractive profession. It's evolving away from its working class roots, and it's attracting educated people. It's also attracting people at the national level who have the expectation that they are part of a global elite. And as you become more competitive for the talent, you have to ask yourself, how do you develop and nurture that talent and keep that talent? And these are people who think of themselves as writers. That's primarily how they identify. How do you keep writers satisfied unless they have freedom to write? And that, I think, is pushing the conventions of journalism, because you've got to give people a role glorious enough to meet their own self-image.
Or if you're James Risen, you just simply write a book and force the newspaper to publish.
Well, book writing is what a lot of talent left for. They would quit to go write books because there they could unfold as a writer, and they're trying to keep those people.
In Fink and Schutzen's paper, they argued that the rise in contextual journalism is, quote, easily the most important change in reporting in the past half century. It is a form of journalism with no settled name, no hallowed or even standardized place in journalism's understanding of its own recent past. Why does this type of journalism have no name?
Well, because it is convenient for the New York Times to change the value proposition it is giving readers without necessarily changing the language for the product. So over time, the New York Times exchanged what happened yesterday for what's happening and what it means. They made that trade, but they didn't change the language for what they were doing, because to change the language would invite a holy war inside the institution about such questions of, do we want to have more opinion in the news pages of the New York Times? If you actually raise that question, you would cause a civil war. So it's easier to just change the product, keep the language the same, and the result is readers are confused, but that we've accomplished what we wanted to do.
But do we hold the New York Times to a higher standard than we hold other newspapers? First, because it's such a great newspaper, I get things from both left and right talking about how the New York Times is biased. The left says it's the voice of the establishment. The right says it's a liberal mouthpiece. And they can pick articles to prove their point either way.
Well, I think one thing to consider is that the Times is held to a particularly high standard by people on the right and the left. And one of the reasons that goes into that is that the Times is terribly influential. So if an issue is presented in the Times and you on the left or on the right have a stake in that issue, you have to be concerned not only with whether you think the article is accurate, but also what's the impact of that article. And if you feel that the article is impactful and adverse to your perspective, then you are deeply concerned. And that accounts for a lot of the response and activism that arises when the Times publishes something.
Well, I guess I have to take a little break. We'll come back to my guests, Arthur Brisbane, former public editor at the New York Times, Vanessa Ghazari, managing editor of Columbia Journalism Review, and Jay Rosen, a journalism professor and media critic at New York University. We are talking about the rise of interpretive journalism, and we will continue the conversation after this. We are back with Jay Rosen, journalism professor, media critic at New York University, Vanessa Ghazari, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Arthur Brisbane, the former public editor at the New York Times, talking about the rise of interpretive journalism. And you wanted to say something, Jay, before we went to the break?
When you talk about the New York Times as compared to any place else in the news landscape, you must remember that you are always in the realm of obsession. People are obsessed with it. The people who work there are obsessed. They got there by being obsessed. The critics of the New York Times are obsessed with it. Every elite in New York City that sees itself reflected in the New York Times is obsessed with that treatment. And I think the correspondence of the public editor, I'm sure, bears that out.
You've said that today we say media instead of the press. Is there much significance in that?
Yes, I prefer the antiquated term press because it connects backward to the First Amendment. The First Amendment doesn't say freedom of media, and to the political role of a free press in the founding of our democracy. The media, to me, is a much more ambiguous creature. It's the result of society and technology for communication coming together and flowering into this powerful social institution, but it doesn't necessarily have the public service mission that the press does.
Well, I guess media is more popular because of the growth of digital journalism and the internet. Has that enabled the growth of contextual journalism?
I think it has, in the sense that if you think about one of the aspects of contextual journalism being length, the internet certainly allows for people to write longer. It also allows people to write shorter, of course. But I think that there is a tendency that journalism at large has to be sort of careful about on the internet to do less reporting and more kind of opining and thinking. It's much easier to kind of sit down and write something. Much more of that is happening. And this is obviously connected to also shrinking budgets in traditional media for the kinds of reporting that really define what we do, I think. I did just want to say that, and this is slightly to go back to something that you were speaking about earlier when you mentioned interpretive journalism. It's worth noticing that this is not just something that's happened to journalism in the second half of the 20th century and into this century, but the social sciences, too, which have increasingly become interwoven with journalism. And we see the impact of that, you know, rising throughout the 70s and 80s. And certainly now it's sort of, I mean, if you think about the recent piece that the New York Times did on nail salons, for example, that was, you know, as one person put it to me recently, essentially like a sociology PhD thesis in the way that it was structured. And in all of these social science disciplines, there's been a growing sense of self-consciousness, not just journalism. So this idea of, wait, who are we who are telling this story? And I think that's also something that's happening.
You could see it as a shift in the nature of trust from trust us because we're the authorities and we don't have a view, we don't have a bias, to trust us because here's where we're coming from.
Exactly.
And here's what we now had concluded in this investigation. And that's a different kind of trust. So this is another thing that's going on here, is that authority in journalism is increasingly related to transparency in journalism. And as transparency becomes more important, then we want to know from the journalists we're trusting, where are you coming from? And that is also involved in this shift.
Are we talking about a postmodern perspective, cultural relativism? Every perspective has inherent value?
What I wanted to add there is that every perspective has an audience. Every journalist has a perspective, and you're seeing the matchup of the journalist's perspective with the audience segment that buys into it. Between them, they trust each other. But if you're not in that narrow lane that they occupy of their perspective, the audience and the writer, you look at it with distrust. So one of the things that's occurred is the digital revolution has created so many of these lanes of perspective, and hence a lot of people are cranking out a lot of points of view, and they're reaching fragmented audiences who like what they're reading.
Media organizations such as Vox focus on explaining the news. In what way is explanatory journalism different from opinion writing, or what the Times has been doing with The Upshot?
Here's the deal with Vox. In the news system before the internet, people regularly received news stories that were updates on larger stories that they didn't know about. So if you lack the background necessary to know where we are in the story, the latest update actually doesn't do you any good at all. So we used to have a news system that constantly gave people updates to stories where they came in the middle of the movie. So Vox's proposition is, if we're better at catching people up so that if they came in the middle of the movie, they can see the whole story, then they will be more interested in the updates.
The Times of London used to have a policy in which they never updated anything. Every news story was just what had happened, and they assumed that you, as a reader of the Times, would know.
Continuous attention.
Yes. A number of listeners have been calling in because of the Times coverage of Bernie Sanders. They are saying that that he's been covered and not been covered in ways that have been slanting the news. Others have complained about how Hillary Clinton has been covered. I'm not sure the Times has been criticized for what they've done with Donald Trump, because everybody seems to be dumping on Donald Trump.
On the other hand, Donald Trump seems to be going over rather well with a large
yes.
segment of the country, so you have to wonder about that.
And so has Bernie Sanders to some degree, but there were people who have – there have been a number of criticisms that he's been left out of articles that are about his big issues, or that whenever they talk about him, they talk about him as having been a hippie and a radical.
Here's what I would say. The original reason for balance and objectivity and neutrality in news accounts – was to keep extreme things from coming into the paper and from extreme claims from being published as fact. And yet there's an extremism in objectivity and balance that never gets recognized either. The extreme need to quote both sides, the extreme need to see it as a 50-50 proposition.
So global warming becomes, instead it becomes 98% scientists believe one thing.
Among other problems,
it becomes a 50-50
Correct.
Proposition.
So sometimes there's a centrist bias to political coverage that does work to the detriment of a candidate like Bernie Sanders. And that could be different than Times reporters trying to sink Bernie Sanders. They could just be holding on to their centrist bias.
I also think with Bernie Sanders, it's very interesting to ask why journalists have treated his candidacy. This is not a new complaint that people have had about Bernie Sanders' coverage. I think journalists are used to being called liberals, many of them, at least in the mainstream press. And I think they're self-conscious about that. And many of them want to do everything they can to not be tagged as a liberal. And I think Bernie Sanders is reaping the benefits or the
costs.
The costs.
Well, I think another thing is at work, and that is that with interpretive journalism being in full throat, political reporters come into a campaign with some pretty set ideas as to who's a potentially serious candidate and who's probably not. And those ideas die very, very hard. And I can't help but believe that the coverage of Bernie Sanders isn't affected by that. Likewise, Donald Trump. Both candidates are entirely surprising in their success. That flies in the face of what the journalistic mindset is at the start of a campaign. Journalists don't respond as quickly as perhaps they should.
We're speaking with Arthur Brisbane, former public editor at the New York Times, Vanessa Ghazari, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Jay Rosen, a journalism professor and media critic at New York University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In 2007, way back then, The Onion ran an article which said, "Most emailed list tearing New York Times newsroom apart." It's funny, but there's a problem in that it's now so easy for bosses and journalists to measure their worth in terms of clicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the end, isn't there that also a temptation to cover a story in a certain way rather than another way? I mean, the old-fashioned way, who, when, where, and how. Now we wind up with a lot of articles sounding like the beginnings of a short story.
So-and-so
entered
thing?
The room and she looked at trepidation at the man seated to her left.
Actually, the one bias that most mainstream journalists will admit to is the bias for a good story or the dramatic bias, right, of seeing events as more dramatic than they actually are. As when Mark Halperin says that the latest poll from Iowa is a game change, which he did say a couple of days ago because the numbers were a little bit different, and he called that a game change.
Now,
well,
that's the
drama bias, right, of making everything into a huge story when it's actually not.
Well, there's been complaints over past elections of the tendency of reporters to treat it all as a narrative and wanting to find the narrative.
Or a game.
On the other hand, I mean, that's our job, right? I mean, suppose that we just took a bunch of notes and put that in the paper. That's not our job. Our job is to make meaning out of information.
Well, I want to address something that was in the Columbia Journalism Review. FOIA just published a piece on the Freedom of Information Act and called the process broken. According to the article, denials are at record highs, navigating the bureaucracy can be a nightmare, and the federal agencies recently killed a modest reform bill. And absent any change in the law, the best way for news organizations to make sure it stays relevant is to use FOIA innovatively and aggressively. Why are legacy news organizations like the New York Times reluctant to file FOIA requests?
I didn't know they were.
I don't think they are.
Yeah.
That article got it wrong?
No, I think the article talks about the Times as being an exception among the article is about the declining number of traditional, what we think of as legacy media, filing, using FOIA, and how new media organizations, digital natives like BuzzFeed and others, have really beefed up their use of FOIA. You know, FOIA continues to be a hugely important tool for journalists, and I think part of the argument that this writer, Trevor Tim, is making in the piece is that actually organizations need to sue more because many requests are not satisfied and not for necessarily legal reasons.
We don't have a lot of time, but I want to bring up the press conference in which Donald Trump had Univision journalist Jorge Ramos forcibly removed from the room after he repeatedly asked about Trump's call to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants and build a wall the length of the Mexican border. Are we seeing fewer journalists in the American press who are willing to confront authority, particularly politicians?
I think there's a reluctance to do what Jorge Ramos did, and stand up like that and take, you know, the intense heat from a political leader.
And then a lot of people have criticized him for being disrespectful and rude.
Yeah, and they've criticized him because he says he is coming from somewhere. He believes that he's fighting for the human rights of the audience that watches Univision. And that's part of how he does his journalism. And a lot of American journalists jeer at Ramos rather than objecting to what Trump did. And I find that to be remarkable.
You've each taught journalism to college students. Are there certain aspects of journalism or ethics that your students have told you they struggle with most?
I think students that have to ask people uncomfortable questions,
invading
their privacy, always speak about it if they're honest.
I think one thing that I've heard is that the sort of value or paradigm of objectivity, as Jay was saying earlier, has fallen into, if not disrepute, just it's not seen as a value, and young journalists also hear though that they should try to achieve balance in their articles. I think there's a lot of confusion that enters the mind of an aspiring journalist about what is the proper approach to constructing a story, if not objectivity. What then?
Wanted to add to that?
There's confusion because an elite that runs these newsrooms doesn't want to give up the consensus it learned on the job.
Thank you all so much for being on today's show, talking about the rise of interpretive journalism. Arthur Brisbane, former public editor at The Times, Vanessa Gazzari, managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Jay Rosen, journalism professor and media critic at NYU. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.